Last week I spoke on overcoming fear, and I talked about the scripture over in 1 John chapter 4 verse 18 specifically about how perfect love casts out fear. And I showed that within the context, if you look at the context of that particular section, it talks about that perfect love really being in us, yes, but it also, which comes from God, but it also is around us as well, in that sense that God is in charge of all things, and it certainly does chase away fear in that regard. I brought out the definition that is given over in 1 Corinthians 13 as it applies into those two particular areas. And also I pointed out, I'll point everybody to 2 Peter chapter 1, where Peter talks about how the various stages exist in developing the kind of love that God has, this kind of godly love. Now what I want to do today is I want to actually continue the series on health, which I started a few weeks ago. The sermon series really, which is on caring for our physical temple. But what I want to do is I want to talk about the link between the mind and health. And obviously the sermon or the Bible study that I gave last week certainly has a great deal to tell us regarding what our minds should be, and certainly chasing away the fears that we have of one description or another, particularly as we go, as Mr. Munro was talking about, moving from this point into the future. It certainly is an important aspect. But there are two areas I want to talk about really today, two overall areas. First of all is the mind and health, yes. But secondly, I want to talk about relationships, because relationships really, they affect our minds an enormous amount. And our relationship with God is of paramount importance. I'll be concentrating mainly on the relationships between human beings, because that really is where you look in the world, and you actually look at the way in which people recognize this mind link to health. That's the relationships that tend to come out. So in the area of the mind itself, I've got 4 points I want to deal with. First of all, I want to talk about the mind as a gland, because that is really what the mind is. It's not just an electrical computer. It's actually a gland as well. It's the same as the adrenal glands or the pituitary gland or the thyroid, and I believe there's actually a calcium gland that's in the back of the thyroid. I only found out just the other day, which I never even knew about, that actually governs all the calcium balance in the body. And there are, if you ever chop up an animal, you find all these different glands. So the mind is a gland. Secondly, I want to deal with gut reaction, because the alimentary canal almost has a mind of its own. I want to just talk about that in some people. But thirdly, I want to talk about the heart, because the heart also is affected by the mind enormously. And finally, these 4 points coupled with the actual mind itself, I want to talk about the bones. Because there's a lot within scripture that talks about the bones, and the bones really is where the blood comes from to some degree, to a large degree actually. In the area of relationships, I want to stress the fact that we've got problems at the end time. There are problems specifically mentioned regarding relationships at the end time. And those relationships really go through all throughout life. So the other points I want to deal with, I want to talk about the unborn, the relationship with the unborn. I want to talk about the relationship between the breastfeeding child and its mother, between children in general and their parents, and finally between adults. Because those relationships all have a bearing on the mind and the health of the individual and the health of our society, quite frankly. And therefore these things are very, very important for us to get to grips with. Now, when we're looking at the mind as really as a gland, as a means of controlling much that is in the rest of the body, there's a great deal of research that's been done. This particular quotation is from a man called Tom Ferguson, who's a doctor who founded the Journal of Medical Self-Care. And this particular section under a heading that says panic is as a disease, he's talking, he says, when I speak of the brain doing its job, I don't mean trying to think oneself into a higher state of consciousness. I'm talking about the human brain as a gland. So in other words, the brain as it functions and it thinks and it does various things, it then releases chemicals into the bloodstream, the same as the adrenal glands above the kidney. The adrenal glands above the kidney, if you get a sudden shock or whatever, it presumably comes from the brain through the chemicals into the blood, or perhaps even direct nerves across the adrenals, which then pump adrenaline into the bloodstream, and these things are all in balance. But he says, I'm talking about the human brain as a gland, the most prolific gland in the human body. 5 years ago, when I came to UCLA, I asked my colleagues at the Brain Research Institute for a list of all the secretions produced by the brain. Now, this was written, what year was this actually written on? I don't see the year, but anyway, it's not that recent. It must be about a good 10 years old, so it would be about 15 years ago. Brain research, a list of all the secretions produced by the brain. I received a list of 34 substances. Some of these allowed the body to alleviate its pain. Some helped combat infections. Others helped fortify the immune system, all coming out of the brain. And presumably the pituitary gland, which is underneath the base of the brain, and it's these 34 substances. Today, that's 5 years later, they don't even dare to count the number of brain secretions. The brain can combine the subunits available to it into an almost infinite number of substances. So from the subunits, from the units that it has available, it will mix them and chemically prepare subunits and pump them into the bloodstream to have certain effects, and these effects then have an effect on the entire body. And it is a physiological thing. It's something physical that they can actually determine, that this is happening from our brains, that the actual body is being affected. It says the brain is a powerful apothecary. In some circumstances, it can secrete and prescribe substances far more helpful than any drugs, but under circumstances of fear, panic, pain, exasperation, or rage, it is extremely difficult for the brain to produce the appropriate substances. And he talks about, Dr. Franz Ingelfinger, the late editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, estimated that 85% of the patients who see doctors could handle the problem on their own. 85% of people who go down to doctors could go ahead and look after the problem themselves. That is to say, 85% of the illnesses for which we go to doctors can be handled by the body's own healing powers. And an awful lot of that comes out of our approach. What we actually do and think, not only what we do and what we have in our mind, have in our mouths and eat and so on, but in what we think and how we think and how we approach life. That has a great deal to say. Deuteronomy 7. Turn over to Deuteronomy chapter 7. In Deuteronomy 7, it says, verse 9, "Know therefore that the Eternal your God, he is God, the faithful God, that keeps his covenant and mercy with those that love him, and keeps his commandment to 1,000 generations. So he repays them that hate him, and their face to destroy them." And notice the context. He goes into verse 13, "And I will love you and bless you and multiply you, bless the fruit of your womb, the fruit of your land, your corn." In other words, the things, if you're keeping God's way, then physically, these people would have been physically blessed. Yes, they had rituals to do morning, noon, and night to try and remind them of these things. But if they'd kept God's way, they would have been blessed physically. "You will be blessed," as it says, verse 14, "of all people. There will not be a male or female barren among you, among your cattle. And the Eternal will take away from you all sickness, and will put none of the evil diseases of Egypt, which you know, upon you, but will lay them upon those that hate you." Why upon those that hate him? Well, how much of that was actually coming from their brain function? Because they're hating the nation that is going along God's way. If you hate a nation going along God's way, you're going to have some problems. And this gland, I mean, we certainly can recognize that the stomach produces stomach ulcers. But you know, the brain is incredibly powerful. Incredibly powerful as a gland within the body. And the way that brain works and the way that it pumps secretions into the very bloodstream has an effect on the entire body chemistry, and the not just the chemistry, but even every single organ, every single cell is linked up to that brain. This particular man, this Tom Ferguson, mentions the following. He says, one of the most interesting experiments I know involved two pills, a super tranquilizer and a super stimulant. The subjects were 100 volunteer medical students. Now, these were very strong drugs. The tranquilizer, a green capsule, was held up before them, and all the effects, including side effects, were carefully described. Next, a red pill, a super stimulant, was held up, and all its effects was described. Then half the students got red and the other half got the green ones, and what the students didn't know was that the contents of the pills have been switched. The green pills really contain the stimulant, and the red pills contain the tranquilizer. And it said both groups of students experienced very specific and consistent symptoms, but not the symptoms that should have been produced by the drugs they took. A majority of each group experienced the exact symptoms that had been described to them. The students' bodies created the expected effect, even though to do so they had to overcome the opposing effect of a very powerful drug. Now, what does that tell you about the mind and about this cocktail that is going into our bloodstreams when our minds think in a certain way? What does this tell us? It tells us that in this case, the human body was more powerful than the medicine. Now, we know, I mean, when we look, turn over to Isaiah 32. Isaiah 32. Now, I was hoping to actually do 3 points today. We'll see whether I can even get 1 point done, but... No, 3 overall points, but I basically thought I would leave the final point, which is to do with healing. I'll leave that until nearer Passover, and we'll deal with that at Passover itself. But here in Isaiah 32, the whole of Isaiah 32 is of interest. But if we pick it up where it talks about, wait, verse 1, it says, behold, a king will reign in righteousness and princes will rule in judgment. You're looking forward into the future, into the very millennium itself. And it talks, verse 15, that all these problems that people will have will be until the Spirit is poured out upon us from on high, and the wilderness is a fruitful field, and a fruitful field counted as a forest. And then judgment will dwell in the wilderness, and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The mind functions will be put right, and the work of righteousness shall be peace. The effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever, and my people shall dwell in a peaceable habitation, sure dwellings in quiet resting places. You look in today's society, in today's cities, are they quiet resting places? Do we have that within society today? And the answer is obviously we don't. But you know, when you look at what God did initially, he put man in a garden. He created man and he put him into a garden so that the mind would have a quiet resting place. And certainly it the mind has a phenomenal power as a gland. It's actually secreting things into the bloodstream. And to give you an example of that, there's a man called Norman Cousins, and this is a review that I've got here of a book that he wrote called The Anatomy of an Illness. And he says, Norman Cousins turned life-threatening adversity into a profound growth experience for himself and a healing journey for the multitudes he reached through the telling of his story. He says, stricken in 64 with ankylosing spondylitis, a severe connective tissue disease, Cousins perceptively concluded early on his hospital regime of lifeless food, powerful anti-inflammatory medicines, constant interruptions was a recipe for disaster. In response, he did something quite radical for the time. This was back in 64. You know, when you think back to 64, the doctor was God. But here he was, he said, no, enough of this nonsense. And he said he did something quite radical. He used the layperson's intellect to explore the nature of his disease and to fashion an unconventional protocol for recovery. Concluding that he wouldn't recover if he continued with the suppressive medications that it were and still are the medical standard for such diseases, yet understanding the need to counteract the debilitating effect of the inflammatory process of work in his body, Cousin formed ahead with a regime built on megadoses of both vitamin C and laughter. He combined the vitamins with a steady diet of Candid Camera and the Marx Brothers. He found that 10 minutes of genuine belly laughter had an anesthetic effect and would give me at least 2 hours of pain-free sleep. So he couldn't sleep because of this disease, and that was just basically wearing him completely away. So he said, get rid of all the medicines, and he dosed himself with vitamin C, and that's, you know, that's questionable, but nevertheless, that's what he felt. When the sedimentation rate, which measures the degree of inflammation, was tested immediately after a laughing spell, it says it decreased. This objective measure corroborated what he already knew, that he was on the right track and would let nothing dissuade him from it. And basically, he went ahead and he cured himself through that regime, because he saw the way in which the mind was working. And that mind, from the laughter that he had, was pumping chemicals into the bloodstream and making a difference to the rest of the body. It actually, the inflammatory connective tissues were no longer inflamed, because the blood going around them was actually healing, was a benefit to him. Now, when we look at this subject, there's, you know, I mentioned about the gut, and there's an article I saw the other day, which is here. And it's got a thing called Man Has a Brain in Here, and it's got a finger pointing to somebody's rather large belly. But in this particular article, it's saying, anyone eager to make his mark in finding a new species of living creature should forget the Amazon rainforest and ocean depths and look closer to home. Scientists believe that the human intestine still harbors scores of undiscovered organisms. Too bad that the work on the gut lacks the glamour of research on the heart or the brain, but never mind, with Christmas excesses having given way to the New Year austerities, what better time to chew over the state of the gut, or rather gut research? So he goes into this, he says, for a start, the gut has a brain, nerves and nerve pathways wrapped around it, and sometimes referred to as the little brain in the gut. And the nervous system of the gut has all the types of nerve cell that the brain has, said the anatomist, Professor Michael Gerson of New York Columbia University. So here, you know, the actual intestines, the most lowly part of our bodies in many ways, actually have a mental capacity. You know why? Because it's got to determine what kind of food's coming through. It's got to deal with each type of food differently, and the nerves on the outside of the actual intestinal wall determine this. It doesn't have to go to the brain to do it. The nerves are actually in there. They have almost like a mind of its own, and that, you know, it really is quite remarkable. But then what happens? Let's have a look at some proverbs. Let's turn over to Proverbs chapter 13. Proverbs chapter 13. And just go through some of the proverbs, and you'll see that, yes, God understands this, that the way in which our minds work also has an effect on our bodies, and particular on this particular area of our anatomy. It says, verse 25 of Proverbs 13, the righteous eats to the satisfying of his soul, but the belly of the wicked shall want. Now, does that mean that the belly of the wicked will want? In other words, it'll lack nutrient? Well, it's not just nutrient or lack food, because the wicked, it talks about the wicked being prosperous and, you know, having, you know, you can read the Psalms and so on, other parts of the scripture, where they have more than enough. But it still lacks. There's a lack there, because the way in which the mind is thinking. Notice Proverbs chapter 18. It says, Proverbs 18, verse 8, it says, the words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down to the innermost parts of the belly. Now this, again, it ties in with this particular subject which is being dealt with in this article. Which talks about there's more immune cells, apparently, within the area of the gut than anywhere else in the body. Do you know why? Because, if you like, it's part of the outside that's inside us. In other words, it's outside food, outside bacteria that are passing through us. And you know the area is of the actual intestine. If you took all the villi and you flattened them all out, they'd be the size of two tennis courts. if you flatten the actual area of the intestine, of the human intestine out. And that area then has got to be protected. So it's talking about the more immune cells. So when you're looking at, in here in verse 8, where it says, the words of a talebearer are as wounds, and they go down into the innermost parts of the belly. Here's the mind, here's the brain, with its cocktail of messengers, and it has an effect with the messengers that are there around the actual gut area as well. And if you hear the words of a talebearer, and how they go right into the innermost part of our being. And it is not just it's not just a case of a poetic phrase. There is actually a literal side to this. It's more than just a poetic phrase here. Notice in verse 20, it says, a man's belly shall be satisfied with the fruit of his mouth, and with the increase of his lips shall he be filled. Now again, you can look at it in one way, in the fact that if somebody uses his mouth wisely, he'll therefore have more money and therefore have more to eat. But there's also more to it than that. It also has an effect on us insofar as the actual, as I say, this cocktail that's coming out of the brain that's having effect on the various organs, and one of those organs is the very gut itself. Proverbs chapter 20. Proverbs chapter 20, verse 27. It says, the spirit of man is the candle of the eternal, searching all the inward parts of the belly. So, you say, well, the spirit of man dwells in the brain. Yes, it does. But here it seems to be that there's more to it than that. That it's the whole man, it's the whole being. You know, this again, when you're looking at Gnosticism, when you look at the old lie of Gnosticism, and the old lie of Gnosticism is alive and well in the world today, you're looking at this Epicureanism where you basically go out and eat, drink and be merry, and you try and satiate the senses and therefore have all this abundance of mental stimulation. That is one form, this hedonism. And the other form is asceticism, where you deny the body so that the soul may be more righteous. But that's both of them are satanic. Both are satanic. That's not the way of God. The way of God is that we function as a human being, which is a physical human being, and we function in the optimal way, physically, mentally, spiritually, in every way. And so when you're looking here, where it says in verse 27, it says, the spirit of man is the candle of the eternal. This is what the eternal can see. Searching all the inward parts of the belly. It goes down into the physical realm as well. It's not just a case of just the mental process in the mind. Even our entire body is open to God. And it seems to be, according to this verse, it seems to be according to the actual spirit of man. Proverbs 26. It says, verse 22, the words of a talebearer are as wounds. They go down into the innermost parts of the belly. And again, it's backing up what we read earlier on in this particular area. But as I say, these gut reactions that we have, and so often today, we do find within our society that people have problems with that part of the anatomy. They are. Now, yes, there are problems there with the foods that we eat, but there are also problems there with the way in which we think and the stress under which we find ourselves. So they all have an impact. They all have an impact on our entire body, our entire physical being. Now, if we go back a few pages in Proverbs, over to Proverbs 13, and have a look at the heart, the Bible certainly does seem to indicate that the heart, we can look at it, the heart becoming sick being a case of the mental center, because the heart is the last organ that you come to within the body. You can look at it figuratively as the mental center, because over here in Proverbs chapter 13 verse 12 it says, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but when the desire comes, then it's a tree of life. And people can say, oh well, it's just talking figuratively. Well, no, there's more to it than that. And certainly when you start looking at the examples that you find between, you know, the people have actually found, you know, they've taken place. Let me read you one. This is, again, coming from this book, this Panic as a Disease, from this Tom Ferguson. It says, about a year ago at UCLA, I was asked to see a 34-year-old man who thought that he was going to die. Larry had gone for a checkup the previous week. His doctors had taken one look at his electrocardiogram, his EKG, and asked him, when did you have your heart attack? Larry gasped, I've never had a heart attack. Oh, yes, you have, the doctor said. It's right here. The EKG doesn't lie. You have an unmistakable heart attack. You don't remember having any chest pain? No, Larry said, I've never had any chest pain. Well, the doctor said, you've had a silent coronary, a massive heart attack. Are you sure you don't remember having any pain? He says, that night, for the first time in his life, Larry had chest pain. He worried himself into a state of severe panic. Early the next morning, he went back to the clinic. They put him on a treadmill. Moments later, there was a sharp drop in his blood pressure, an ominous change in his EKG. They put him in the hospital, gave him an angiogram, ran a catheter up into his heart, injected a dye, took x-rays. This is what the medical profession is doing. It's playing around. It is practicing in many ways. The x-ray showed a substantial blockage of the major arteries in his heart. They scheduled Larry for coronary bypass surgery, but he was so emotionally devastated that his doctors feared that he couldn't withstand the procedure. I just recovered from a heart attack myself, so they asked me to see him. Now, this was a doctor going in to see this particular patient. When I came to Larry's hospital room, these first words were, I don't want to die. I said, what makes you think you're going to die? The doctor said, I've had a serious heart attack, he said. I flunked my treadmill test. I flunked my angiogram. My EKG is all screwed up. And now they say I've got to have a major heart surgery. I sat down beside him, put a hand on his shoulder. You know, Larry, I said, I've heard and read a good deal about your case, and I think you've got a really great heart. And I've got a hunch that if we can get you back into that treadmill room without those doctors scaring your heart to death, you'll knock the socks off that thing. And he looked surprised. He said, why do you say that? You've never had any symptoms in your life. I don't think you could have had a serious heart problem without knowing about it. These tests can be wrong, especially in younger men with strong, muscular hearts. And I showed him some papers by the great cardiologist, Paul Dudley White, to prove it. So, you know, here's some people looking at the superficial evidence, say, there's a blockage there, and we're going to go ahead and give bypass surgery to him. I saw him every day for 3 days, finally able to convince him to give the treadmill another try, and we went to the treadmill room an hour and a half early. I told him some funny stories to get him in a good mood. I arranged him to operate the controls himself, because one of the flaws of the treadmill is that when you're on it, you don't exercise it, it exercises you. The floor under your feet starts to move, and if you don't run, you fall over. If you can control the whole thing yourself, the experience is totally different. So I got the machine on the machine first. We make a game of it. I ran while Larry operated the controls. Gradually he began to lose his fear of the machine. Then he got on, started out slowly, gradually increased his speed. After 5 minutes of steady running, he was doing fine. We had music playing. He was laughing, cracking jokes. Finally said, bring the man in. We invited the cardiologist in. Larry operated the machine. The doctor watched the EKG and followed his blood pressure. Larry gradually increased his screen and increased the upward angle of the treadmill. 3 miles an hour with a 15-degree uphill grade, he was still feeling no discomfort of any kind. After 20 minutes of strenuous exercise, he was still perfectly comfortable. He exhibited no symptoms at all. The doctors turned off the machine and they cancelled the surgery. Now, what does the brain do? How does the brain work? It pumps in this cocktail of chemicals within to our minds. From our minds, and those chemicals then they can affect all kinds of organs. One of those organs is the very heart itself, and as it says here, hope deferred makes the heart sick. Well, I thought I was going to have a long life, but he just told me I'm going to die. I'm going to have this open bypass surgery. It's all and so on. And you see what happens. I know that some time ago, I had to go to hospital, many years ago now, and the only time I've ever been in hospital, and it was for the heart. And it basically, the heart started fibrillating, it started beating in an erratic way, and they got me in there and did tests, and I went on this treadmill and so on, and after about a day or so it went back to normal, and I think I had one repeat problem, and then that's it. Never had any kind of problem since then. I've done windsurfing and all sorts. So I know firsthand But at that time, where were we? We were right in the middle of worldwide, right in the middle of people getting up in services, going ahead and trying to shout me down. That kind of thing. Is it any wonder you get heart problems in that kind of atmosphere? Of course it is. And yet, you know, we do. Some areas of the medical profession actually dismiss this. And yet it's a vital part of our overall health. It says, an article that's of back in 2nd of the 9th, 04. Anyway, back in, what's the 9th? September, isn't it? It says, stress does increase the risk of a heart attack. Hey, so it does. Stress is a cause of heart attacks, after all, and is nearly as important as smoking, according to a study. The Inter-Heart study among 29,000 people in 52 countries, half of whom had experienced heart attacks, found that the psychosocial factors increased the risk of a heart attack 2.5 times, while smoking increased the risk nearly 3 times. So it's almost as important, as far as heart attacks are concerned, as smoking. So somebody who smokes and yet has a healthy outlook on life is probably in the same kind of area as somebody who doesn't smoke but who's dour, and maybe particularly the angry person that seems to be a problem with the heart. Another, this particular individual, this Tom Ferguson, he gives another example. Again, he's particularly interested in the heart. It says the same kind of encouragement and support could help people survive heart attacks. The reason so many people do die, 50% within the first day, is not the heart attack itself. It's largely because of the panic that almost always accompanies it. And he then goes through it. He says, you're a 55-year-old man, home at dinner, suddenly you feel some sharp pains in your chest, become very afraid, you're stuck in the kitchen, I think I'm having a heart attack. Somebody calls the neighbors, people come into the house, running back and forth, calls the hospital, paramedics arrive, they stick needles in your arms, mask over your face, put you on a stretcher, put you into a high-speed ride up to the hospital, lights flashing, siren wailing. And if you think the sirens sound hideous coming down the street, you can hardly imagine what it sounds from inside the ambulance. Then you get put in through the hospital doors that says emergency. You then go down into the intensive care unit, and all your relatives and friends are kept outside, and so on. And he says, as I mentioned before, I had a heart attack myself not long ago. Just recently, I had a chance to observe the same process again. I was driving past a golf course in Los Angeles when an ambulance drove in. I followed it. The ambulance pulled up beside a man in golfing clothes lying on a stretcher. He was in a state of total panic. His skin was ashen. His lips were trembling. His eyes were closed. The paramedics ran up to him and began doing what they had to do, connected him onto an oxygen tank, hooked up the EKG, stuck several needles in his arm, but nobody was talking to him. You see, there you are. There's your relationship problem. They treat people as machines. That is what a hospital does. That's what the drug companies are doing. They experiment on animals as machines. They treat humans as machines. But the brain has an enormous... Remember the two pills. The brain has an enormous influence. We are a holistic creature that God has created. God has put this brain into us, and we have to use this brain in a certain way, and he has programmed it so that if it's used in the way that he thinks, it produces the right things. If we use against the way he thinks, it produces the wrong things and damages even the very body itself by this cocktail that comes out of the brain itself. It says the EKG monitor showed a tachycardia, a runaway pulse with a regular heartbeat. I put my hand on his shoulder. He said, "Sir, you've got a great heart." He looked at me, opened his eye, looked at me. "What do you say that?" he says. I gestured toward the monitor. I said, "I'm looking at your EKG. It's been pretty hot out here today. You've probably got a little dehydrated. It's easier to upset the sodium-potassium exchange that's so vital in the proper functioning of the heart. But I assure you, everything's going to be okay. In a few minutes, you'll be the best hospital in the world. Take it easy. Believe me, you're going to do just fine." He opened his eyes, propped up his head, began looking around. Within 30 seconds, then the tachycardia began to recede, and with 90 seconds, he was within the survival range. Now, had he been left without anybody treating him, without anybody treating the mind aspect, he could have been dead. I remember reading it, another case, I haven't got it with me here, of a very fit horsewoman who was sitting or standing, just standing beside the ring while her favourite horse was going over, and the horse broke a leg. And basically she got so worked up standing beside the ring, and she was incredibly fit, she hyperventilated and it killed her. The mind has an enormous influence over us, it really does. When we come into the bones, when we're looking at the bones, let's remind ourselves of something. Genesis chapter 9. Genesis chapter 9. In Genesis 9, he says, God blessed Noah and his sons. He said, be fruitful, multiply, replenish the earth, in verse 1. It talks about every moving thing that will be food for you. And it says, verse 4, but flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, you shall not eat. And the word life there is nephesh. And where it talks, in throughout the Bible, where it talks about the life being in the blood, then the word life is nephesh. It is the living creature. It's very much tied up with the blood. And as we looked at in the Bible study I gave on air, and how air being coming into the lungs, going round the body through the blood, through exercise, actually helps that process along and helps us to keep in the right in the full fitness that we should have. There is another aspect though to blood, and that aspect actually lies in the bone marrow, because the bone marrow, a good deal of the blood is actually, or the actual white corpuscles, I believe, that's the lymph, is it? But certainly the bone marrow is crucial for the blood, the actual manufacture of the blood. If we turn over to Psalm 32, Psalm 32, and we see what God inspires the psalmist to say. Psalm 32, the Psalm of David, says, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man who the Eternal imputes no iniquity, and whose spirit is no guile. When I kept silent, my bones became old through the roaring all day long. So in other words, he kept silent. He didn't, in other words, he bottled things in. The sin that he had was unconfessed. You notice what it says in, blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. But when we keep silent, when we keep our sin bottled up, what does it say? It says, then the bones become old. Because, the mind is programmed by God to function in a certain way. It functions in the way that God lives. If we go along that same way, have that same mindset, then it will pump the right chemicals into that bloodstream. If we go along in the wrong mindset, it'll pump the wrong chemicals in the bloodstream, and we will have repercussions because of that. One of the areas is this unconfessed sin. If we go ahead and just keep quiet about it, and we bottle it all up, then there's a real problem. Notice in Psalm 38, turn over to Psalm 38. It says, O Lord, O Eternal, rebuke me not in your wrath, neither chasten me in your hot displeasure, for your arrows stick fast in me, and your hand presses me sore. There's no soundness in my flesh because of your anger, neither is there rest in my bones because of my sin. And here again, the bones are being affected. The flesh is affected, the bones are affected, and again, you're looking at a mental function. To some degree at least. Let's turn over to Proverbs 14. Proverbs 14. In Proverbs 14, if we notice over in verse 30, it says, a sound heart is the life of the flesh, but envy is the rottenness of the bones. Here's a negative emotion, something that is coming from the mind, the mind is filled with envy. It's not, you know, yeah, yes, the body is all linked together, but the mind starts it all away. The mind fills with envy of for something, and it causes the rottenness of the bones. And it also, Proverbs 17, turn over to page just two, Proverbs 17:22. It says, a merry heart does good like a medicine. So again, you're looking at somebody who's, we've just read about Norman Cousins, who in fact went through the process of, a belly laugh, giving him relief from pain, from quite a serious disease, and it actually prolonged his life. But he says, a merry heart does good like a medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. So, you know, somebody who is just absolutely broken inside, then the bones dry. And what happens when the bones dry? Well, the bones, what's in the bones? It's the marrow. And the marrow is producing the material necessary for the blood. It's the blood, and the life, remember, is in the blood. It's the life that's in the blood that is therefore affected. If you go back to Proverbs chapter 3, we start seeing also, not only is there problems when you have these negative emotions, but in the case of in here in Proverbs 3, notice over in verse 7, it says, do not be wise in your own eyes, fear the eternal and depart from evil, and it shall be health to your navel and a marrow to your bones. In other words, you can get the positive side. It says, don't be wise in your own eyes, fear the eternal, depart from evil. Doing what is right mentally, doing what is right physically, and putting our life back on track, actually has a physical effect on our, as it says here, on the bones themselves. Notice over in Proverbs 15, you know, if we love our neighbors as ourselves, then we should go ahead and remember this particular scripture in the way in which we approach one another. And again, it says in verse 29, the eternal is far from the wicked, but he hears the prayer of the righteous. The light of the eyes rejoices the heart, and a good report makes the bones fat. And the fatness within the marrow is part of what in fact makes the bones function correctly. That is what we look at as far as the marrow being fat, and therefore the blood would therefore be produced. And on the next chapter, notice over in verse 24, verse 23, the heart of the wise teaches his mouth, but is learning to his lips. Pleasant words, verse 24, are as a honeycomb, sweet to the soul and its health to the bones. So again, if we give pleasant words to others, and we don't go ahead and yell at our children, for instance, if the relationships are right, then not only is it pleasant mentally, it's also pleasant physically. Our physical life improves. Now, if we get our relationship with God right, because we're not going to have, we're not going to go through just pleasantries all the time. That's why we've got to go and put our problems to God and go ahead and remember it talks about fear, which I talked about last week. When we're in a fearful position, it's a case of God in us, our perfect love in us, and also that we are in that perfect love. In other words, God is in control ultimately of all, everything. And we've got to understand that this is a loving God that is in control, and therefore that has an effect on us as well. So these all have to be fitted together. Okay, let's go into this problem, therefore, as far as the end time is concerned. There's going to be a problem with relationships at the end time. In Revelation 21, verse 7, let's just remind ourselves of something pretty profound, what God is actually doing through all this, the whole thing. When we're looking at this subject, not just health, but the whole subject of what God is actually doing in the earth, here in Revelation chapter 21, where we just read in the sermonette about the fearful and the unbelieving and the abominable in verse 8, but notice in verse 7 it says, this is the focus of it, it says, he that overcomes shall inherit all things. All things, the whole universe will be, because why? God creates all things. God has created all things. And what does it say? And I will be his God, and he shall be my son. So we actually become the very sons and daughters of God. Now that's what he's, and what do you have as far as a family is concerned? In a proper family, it is a relationship. You have a relationship with your child. You teach your children. We should be teaching our children. And God is wanting that kind of relationship for each and every one of us for eternity. Because, as it mentions over in Genesis, it says we're made in the image of God, in the likeness of him. You know, he's made us, as it says, so that we can be his children. Psalm 115. We find here in Psalm 115 that there's a great deal of difference between the God that we know, you know, the God you can know is a booklet I think Mr. McNair actually wrote, but I thought the title was very apt, because that was what was being undermined by the former association that we were in, you know, through worldwide. But Psalm 115, it says, not unto us, O Eternal, not unto us, but to your name give glory for your mercy and your truth's sake. Why then should we, the nations, say, where is now their God? But our God is in the heavens. He has done whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They've mouths, but they don't speak. Now the inference is, God has a mouth, but he speaks. They have eyes, but they don't see. God has eyes, and he can see. They have ears, they don't hear, but God can hear. It says, noses they have, they don't smell. They have hands, but they don't touch. They don't handle. Now, the relationship between us, and very much in the human realm, does involve touch. It does involve, you know, being close to one another. And it is. It's an important aspect. And today's society, because of the perversion within today's society, that is destroyed. And we find it destroyed from before the actual child is born, all the way through our entire lifestyle, our entire lifetime. They have hands, but they don't handle. Feet they have, they walk not. Neither do they speak, though they through their throat. These idols. You know, what are people putting their trust into? I mean, into cars, into various homes that they've got, or whatever else the idol may be that we have. But it is not a personal relationship which this being that we have a relationship with is capable of, and in fact has designed us to be capable of as well. The relationship is very important to God. Those that make them are like unto them, so is everyone that trusts in them. O Israel, don't trust, he says, trust you in the Eternal. He is their help and their shield. House of Aaron, trust in the Eternal. He is their help and their shield. You that fear the Eternal, trust in the Eternal. He's their help and their shield. The Eternal has been mindful of us, and he will bless us and bless us, the house of Israel. He'll bless us, the house of Aaron. And so this relationship is between somebody who you can have a relationship with, this being that we get on our knees to every single day. And yet we're living in a world, if we turn over to Romans 1, we're living in a world that is perverse, that is twisted, and because it is twisted, and because it doesn't retain this being, this very personal being that wants to have a relationship with us in his mind, and it has a twisted view of many things, then it goes into various deviant mindset, which you're looking, where it says in verse 28, they didn't like to retain God in their knowledge. He gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things that are not proper, not fitting, being filled with all unrighteousness, porneia, fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whisperers, backbiters, haters of God, despiteful, proud, boasters, inventors of evil things, disobedient to parents, without understanding, covenant breakers, without natural affection. All these things, but the natural affection is affected by a certain mindset that goes away from this being who has a mindset that, you know, he has a mouth, he can speak, he has hands, he can touch, he can smell, he can see. He's a personal being. He's an individual. And yet we lose sight of that, and our relationships start getting screwed up. 2 Timothy chapter 3. And this is what's happening in today's society. It says in verse 1, "Know this, that in last days perilous times shall come, because men will be lovers of themselves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, without natural affection, truce breakers." And one of the characteristics that we find today is that this problem with the end time is that we do not have the natural affection and the natural relationships that should be there humanly are being neglected and are missing. I think I gave you an example that we were in the swimming pool one time, I think, with the children, with our grandchildren, and we were talking to the lifeguard. This lady, this girl, had been trained how to fish children out of the pool with her feet, because she wasn't allowed to touch a child. The world is mad. You know, the child is in the process of drowning, and the lifeguard has to go in there and fish it out with his feet. Absolute total insanity. Why? Because they're without natural affection, because their minds are screwed, because they've gone away from God. They've got away from this being whose mind and thinking processes are a certain way. And you get away from that thinking process and it has all kinds of ramifications. And these relationships don't just have ramifications in the society, but they have ramifications on our personal health as well. Our health also gets destroyed. Now, one area which, if you turn over to Jeremiah chapter 1, one area of relationship which you don't tend to even think of, but over in Jeremiah chapter 1, I want you to notice what it says. That here was God having a relationship that somebody he knew. And the word of the Eternal came to me, verse 4, saying, "Before I formed you in the belly, I knew you. Before you came forth out of the womb, I sanctified you. And I ordained you a prophet to the nations." So Jeremiah was a special case. But before he was even born, before he was even conceived, God had a hand in his actual conception. So certain character traits were there that he was going to use, that he wanted to use. And while he grew in the womb, as he says, "Before you came out of the womb, I sanctified you." I said, right, that is the one that I am going to use. There was a relationship there between Jeremiah and God when he was still in the womb. And yet, you know, within our society, there isn't a relationship even between the mother and the child in the womb. We are so far off base. We are so far away from God, that this entire subject, I mean, I'm not going to read some of the stuff, quite frankly, I will not read, but I'd like to just point something out to you which I came across today, which I thought was absolutely staggering. It says, during the tumultuous 1960s, after centuries of legal prohibition and moral condemnation of abortion, a handful of dedicated activists launched an unprecedented marketing campaign. Their aim was twofold: first, to capture the news media and thus public opinion, and then to change the nation's abortion laws. Now, this was a concerted marketing campaign by certain individuals. Their success was rapid and total, resulting in abortion being legalized in all 50 states for virtually any reason and throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. So a child can be murdered in the womb throughout almost all 9 months of pregnancy for almost any reason. And that's the position that we find ourselves today. Since the Supreme Court's controversial Roe v. Wade decision in 73, American doctors have performed well over 40 million abortions. 40 million murders sanctioned by the government performed within the United States alone. 40 million. Although polls consistently show a clear majority of Americans disapprove of unfettered abortions on demand, the movement's well-crafted, almost magical slogans, appealing to Americans' deep-rooted inclination towards tolerance, privacy, and individual rights, have provided the abortion camp a powerful rhetoric arsenal on which to fight off efforts to reverse Roe, which struck down all state laws outlawing abortions. In marketing wars, the party that frames the terms of the debate almost always wins. And the early abortion marketeers brilliantly succeeded in doing exactly like that, diverting attention away from the core issues of exactly what abortion does to both the unborn child and the mother, and focusing the debate instead on newly created issue, choice. Remember, that's what they talked about. The entire thing was choice. Baloney. Why? Because the relationship wasn't there. There's no relationship. It was just something in the womb. Choice for the mother. No longer was the morality of killing the unborn at issue, but rather, who decides? You see how they did it? They took the focus away from whether it's right to murder somebody before they're born. When you're looking at Jeremiah, who was known and sanctified within the womb, and switching it across to choice. Diverting, it's the old magician's trick. The magician has something in his hand over here that he's hiding, but he's showing you the other hand. He's showing the other hand all the time. The original abortion rights slogans for the early 70s, they remain virtual articles of faith and rallying cries for the pro-choice movement of this day, were freedom of choice and women must have control over their own bodies. Remember all those slogans? And they're still being trotted out today. This individual, this particular man, said, "I remember laughing when we made those slogans up," recalled Bernard Nathanson, Bernard Nathanson, a doctor, co-founder of a pro-abortion vanguard group, NARAL, N-A-R-A-L, reminiscing about the early days of the abortion rights movement in the late 60s and early 70s. "We were looking for something sexy, catchy slogan to capture public opinion. There were very cynical slogans then, just as all of these slogans today are very, very cynical." Besides having served as a chairman, and he goes into this particular individual who basically has performed multiple thousands of abortions himself personally and presided over abortions as well. But he says that he starts talking about how in fact this occurred, how this movement actually began. And he and somebody else, another two individuals, got together and they persuaded the media that the cause of the permissive abortion was a liberal, enlightened, sophisticated one, recalls this movement's co-founder. "Knowing that if a true poll were taken, we would be soundly defeated, we simply fabricated the results of fictitional polls." So they basically lied through the teeth. "We announced to the media that we'd taken polls and that 60% of Americans were in favor of permissive abortion." Total fabrication. Nothing behind it at all. That's how it started. This tactic of a self-fulfilling lie, few people care to be in the minority, and we aroused enough sympathy to sell our program of permissive abortion by fabricating the number of illegal abortions done annually in the US. The actual figure was about 100,000. But the figure we gave the media repeatedly was 1 million. So they kept on giving a million, all the various interviews that they had. "Repeating the big lie often enough convinces the public. The number of women dying from illegal abortions was around 200 to 250 annually. The figure we constantly fed the media was 10,000. Total lies. And they managed to swing public opinion. These false figures took root in the consciousness of Americans, convincing many that we needed to crack the abortion law. Another myth we fed the public through the media was that legalizing abortion would only mean that abortions taking place illegally would then be done legally. In fact, of course, abortion is now being used as a primary method of birth control in the US, and the annual number of abortions has increased by 1,500% since legislation." That is the amount. This fraudulent research cost very, very little, and New York immediately became the abortion capital for the eastern half of the United States. Now, that particular individual who did that then started working for, after working in an abortion clinic, he started working with mothers and unborn children and doing research there. And all the technology then started to catch up, and he was able to actually photograph children in the womb. And he took photographs of abortions inside the womb. And then he totally changed his mind. That totally and absolutely changed his mind, and he is now actively trying to stop, to reverse what he and his cohorts started with lies. That's going on right now. But they're not, now that it's actually started, they can't stop it. You can't put the genie back in the bottle again. You've got to destroy the society, because the society is going to be destroyed, because the relationship between the mother and the unborn child has been destroyed. And what's the result of these kind of things? 21st century families. Here's an article from the Telegraph magazine. And what have we got? Single mother, step family, unmarried parents, single father, and the lesbian parents. You can add on to that homosexual parents as well. Our society is sick, and it is without natural affection, and you're looking at a destruction of even the relationship between the mother and the unborn child. Now, do you think that is going to have an effect? Is that going to have an effect in the longer term? Do you think that this kind of thing will have an effect? Now, the natural way, if you are, because you go from the actual, once the child is born, Isaiah 49, turn over there. In Isaiah 49, and in verse 15, well, it says in verse 13, sing, O heavens, be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains. For the Eternal has comforted his people and will have mercy upon the afflicted. But Zion said, the Eternal has forsaken me, and my Lord has forgotten me. Can a woman forget her suckling child, that she should not have compassion on the son of her womb? Yes, they may forget, yet I won't forget you. But you know that relationship is being destroyed. We're lacking natural affection. Within our very societies themselves, kids are being put onto a bottle when they are first, they come out of the womb. Parents are afraid even to cuddle their children in many cases because of the child abuse nonsense. And I say nonsense because the child abuse nonsense that, it's a vile perversion. But then it destroys the relationship between a father and his child. It's destroying the relationships. They will murder children in the womb, but you can't grab your son who's running out in the road and put him over your knee and spank his behind for him. It's destroying the very relationship. And it is having physical effect. It is not just mental effects. The mental, remember what we talked about, the brain is a gland. It has an effect on the entire body, and it is having an effect on the health of the nation, and having an effect on us as individuals. Mothers are advised to breastfeed for an extra 2 months. Here is an article. It says, the advice which brings Britain into line with France and the United States comes as fewer and fewer women breastfeed, citing the demands of juggling childcare and a career and the physical difficulties. And the World Health Organization says 6 months is optimal, but stresses that breastfeeding is an art that has to be learned. Yes, it is. But then you should have had the, if we didn't have these dysfunctional families, you should be able to learn that from your mother, from your grandmother. These things should be automatic. There shouldn't be a problem with it. And yet, here we find it has much more. The relationship in early part of life has an incredible amount of influence on our health later on as well. Let me read you this from the Living magazine of May 1986. It says, do you make a mountain out of every molehill, worrying not just about what's happened, but about what may happen? Do you do that? Did I do that? Yes, sometimes. Do you often seethe inside with indignation, holding on to your anger even after receiving an apology? Do you find it easy to give love, but very hard to accept love and affection from others? Do you tend to retreat into yourself rather than giving vent to your emotions? If you answered yes to all the above questions, you may be putting yourself at risk of cancer. According to Dr. Frederick B. Levinson, a leading American psychoanalyst, with a special interest in treating cancer patients. He goes on about an unhealthy, the reasons why cancer starts: an unhealthy diet, cigarette smoke, viruses, certain chemicals, strong sunlight, a family history of the disease. But Dr. Levinson regards these as the triggers, not the main cause of cancer. So here he's looking at the situation. He says, look, what we're looking at all these things, these physical things that you've got, they're the triggers. But there are things being laid down, mental things being laid down from a very early age that predispose that body to the cancer. He believes that the seeds for cancer are sown in infancy by a mother's failure to bond with her baby. And what do? Well, we need more childcare places. We need to have this woman go out to work. Why? She's got choice. And what's it doing to society? What's it doing to the health of the nation? This is why it's very important. We're within the church. We're the ambassadors for a different organization, a different civilization, a different world. And we've got to approach these things differently. We've got to look at them differently. We are not Gnostics. We're not people who just believe in the immortal soul that has to be therefore perfected. The mind has an effect on the body. It's a holistic thing. And the church has always taught that, and that's what we need to return back to. We do not go ahead and look upon the body as something separate from the mind. The mind is a gland of the body. And God wants us to be going his way in every aspect of our lives. A mother's failure to bond, he says, he believes the seeds of cancer are sown in infancy by a mother's failure to bond with her baby. If he explains, the mother is able to make an emotional relationship with her baby and act as a barrier between him and the outside world, then the child will grow up psychologically healthy and unlikely to suffer from cancer. But if the mother is unable to make that close relationship, and I might add myself, father as well, because the father's not there in the picture. But if the mother is unable to make that close relationship, it may set up a condition he calls hyper-irritation, which in turn may actually cause genetic changes. These genetic changes can be activated into cancer at a later stage in life. The shift in genes, Dr. Levinson explains, is the bomb with its detonator set to go off. All that is necessary is for sufficient irritation in the future to trigger the explosion. So the cells that are laid down. Now you've got a child that you don't really want, that you've aborted, perhaps it's one of its peers. That it's there, okay, we'll go and put it into a crash or whatever we'll do. What kind of, and this unnatural affection that is there, what does it do to the actual child as it's growing in the womb? When it finally comes out, it's got a bottle stuck into its mouth. Is there a bond then between the mother and the child? No. It says a long-term study of more than 2,000 middle-aged American men has shown that a significant association between depression and deaths from cancer. British cancer specialist Dr. Jan de Winter said that a crucial psychological factor in the development of cancer is the suppression of feelings. The onset of cancer frequently relates to an emotional upset, such as bereavement, redundancy, retirement, or a financial crisis. It is, however, not the actual personal grief or the severe blow which causes it. It's the patient's reaction to it, or rather the lack of reaction to it. It's the failure to communicate those feelings which is detrimental. In other words, if you express your feelings, if you tend to bottle them up, then you're more likely to get cancer. Go back to what this God, is this God that is like an idol? The idols have mouths, they don't speak. The idols have hands, but they can't touch. The idols have ears, they can't hear. And yet what do? We have a medical science. We have a science that evaluates human beings as machines. we have a society that rescues children in swimming pools with their feet. There's something very sick, very wrong within our society, and it's to do with relationships. And if those relationships go any further down the tube, which they are going, the society is going to disintegrate. It's in the process of disintegration. We're looking at that right now. And it is also not just disintegration in a moral sense. It's physical. We're looking at the cancers that are there. The inadequate response to them. It says, cancer develops when the mechanism which controls the replacement of the body cell go haywire and allow certain cells to multiply and spread uncontrollably. These rebel cells are cancer cells. They form a tumor which is likely to invade neighboring tissue with potentially fatal consequences. However, cancer cells cannot multiply uncontrollably in this way unless there's also some kind of failure within the immune system which would normally deal firmly with any rebel cancer cells. Poor diet is known to harm the immune system, so too is unrelieved stress, which leads to the release of potentially damaging hormones from the adrenal glands. The glands just above the kidneys. Again, we're a holistic creature, made by God, made to behave in a certain way, in a certain fashion, and if we do behave in that fashion according to God's way, then we will have health. If we behave in a fashion that is against God's way, then we will be ill. These are mental things. And that brain as a gland needs to be kept in mind. When you're coming into teenage as well, you just have to look into society to see what is in fact coming about. This particular headline was from September last year. It says, 1 in 5 teenagers shows signs of heart disease. That's 1 in 5 teens have heart disease signs. The couch potato way of life has become so common that 1 in 5 young teenagers suffers from the early signs of heart disease and strokes. A disturbing new study has found. Tests on children aged 11 to 14 showed 20% with a sort of blood vessel damage normally associated with cardiovascular disease regarded as an adult condition. That's in 11 to 14 year olds within Britain today. Another one here. And remember, where is this coming from? Yes, it's coming from diet. Diet is part of it. Sleep patterns are part of it. Exercise, lack of exercise, yes, that's all part of it. But so is the mental aspect as well. And the lack of relationships and proper relationships within the home also has a bearing on it as well. Another one that was just from just the other day, 26th. What is it today? A couple of days ago. 25% of youths are revealed to be criminals in Britain. 25%, a quarter of the youth of Britain are criminals. It says, 1 in 4 boys aged 14 to 17 has been classified as a serious or prolific offender by the Home Office study published yesterday. So from 14 to 17, a quarter of the boys are classified as a serious or prolific offender. Results from the first Crime and Justice Survey of households in England and Wales found evidence of 1.7 million active teenage offenders. Charles Clarke, the Home Secretary, describing the figures as appalling while emphasising that most of the offences would have been low level, such as failing to pay bus fares or train fares. However, to have qualified as a serious or prolific offender, those who replied to the self-reporting survey had to admit to 6 or more minor offences in the previous 12 months or to one crime from a list that includes assault, theft or selling drugs. So it is serious. It's incredibly serious. Why? What's happening? It's because of relationships. The relationships within society are breaking down, and these are the results. And as we've pointed out, once those relationships start breaking down, it doesn't just affect the social order, it doesn't just affect the mental processes. We're not looking at it in a Gnostic way. We're looking at it as a holistic way, which is the way God looks at it. It affects the health also. Now, when we come to the adults, then we can see quite clearly. Let's turn over to Psalm 127. Psalm 127. You can see quite clearly what God intends. But in Psalm 127, it says, except the Eternal builds the house, they labor in vain to build it. Except the Eternal keeps the city, the watchman watches in vain. And you know, the fortress America at the moment had better understand that. Unless God is protecting America, it's laboring in vain. All these security checks and everything else, they're not going to stop the problem. Because morally, the nation is off. The same with Britain. All this stuff that you see in the newspapers today, where they're bringing in these laws to go ahead and give house arrest without trial, and all their measures against terrorism are going to utterly fail. Why? Because we're morally corrupt. It says, he that keeps the city, except the Eternal keeps the city, the watchmen watch but in vain. It's totally worthless, because the morally it is corrupt. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, to be given, so he gives his beloved sleep. You know, you don't have to burn the candle at both ends to do that. Those the beloved of God do get sleep. And it's interesting that when you look at the lives today, another one, this is from January the 6th, sleepless nights blight millions as they worry about their job. Almost half the people in employment lie awake at night worrying about their work and their home lives, according to a survey published yesterday. More than 4 in 10 Britons admit that they sometimes have difficulties shutting out the professional and domestic concerns when their head hit the pillows. Among those with jobs, the figures rise to 49%, so half the population can't sleep because of the problems that they're going through. But it says here, he gives his beloved sleep. Children are a heritage of the Eternal. The fruit of the womb is his reward. Are they looked like that, looked upon like that in today's society? No, they're not. They try to push out to creches and so on. As arrows in the hands of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that has his quiver full. They will not be ashamed, but they will speak in their enemies in the gate. They'll speak with their enemies at the gate. But what are we doing? We're trying to keep all the enemies out of the country. We're trying to go ahead and use other means. But it says here, unless the Eternal builds a house, they're laboring in vain. All these alternative families are a load of nonsense. Except the Eternal keeps the city, the watchmen watch in vain. They will not go ahead and give security to this particular nation. It's not going to work that way. You see, God is the Creator. And his ways, those who live his ways, are going to be blessed. He's designed it that way. They're going to be blessed physically also. It's interesting where it talks about Jeremiah 31, where it talks about how he'll write their laws on their inward parts. Now, I know it's talking about the new covenant, and the new covenant is to be made with spiritual Israel. But you know, there is also an extension to this, and that is that when the world tomorrow comes, there are going to be physical human beings within Israel and within Judah, and they are going to be destined to be part of that kingdom of God, the same as you and I are part of that kingdom of God. And hopefully God's laws are written on our inward parts as well now in our physical lives, but they will be when we are spirit beings also. And in the same way, at that time, they will be written on the hearts of those physical human beings also. There is that aspect. And part of that writing of God's laws on our inward parts means that when we keep God's laws, and our minds keep God's laws, and are flowing in that way which God has ordained, then that brain that acts as a gland affects every single aspect of our body, whether it's our lungs, our heart, our livers, whether it's our gallbladder, whatever it is, it has an effect. Remember those two pills we talked about, where two strong drugs and switched, but the brain overrid the whole lot, overrode it. Interesting, if you turn over to Proverbs chapter 5, you know, one thing that we have enormous problems with today in society is our sexual health. And Proverbs 5, it says, in my son, attend, listen to my wisdom, and bow your ear to my understanding. that you may regard discretion, and your lips may keep knowledge. For the lips of a strange woman drop as honeycomb, and her mouth is smoother than oil. It looks so good on the outside, but you know, part of this relationship aspect of God's law, part of this relationship aspect of keeping well, keeping fit, is also this sexual health as well. On the surface, it looks so pleasant, but her end is as bitter as wormwood. It's sharp as a two-edged sword. Her feet go down to death. Her steps take hold on hell. Unless you should ponder the path of her life. In other words, you just see and you think, well, should I or shouldn't I? Her ways are movable that you cannot know them. Hear me now, therefore, you children. Depart not from the words of my mouth. Remove your way far from her. This is God speaking directly to us. Remove your way far from her. Do not come near the door of her house, lest you give your honor to others and your years to the cruel, and strangers be filled with your wealth and labors a house of a stranger. And you mourn at the last when your flesh and your body are consumed. And the ride of STDs are legendary within our societies. And say, how have I hated instruction? My heart despised reproof. And I have not obeyed the voice of my teachers, or that inclined my ear to them that instructed me. I was almost in all evil in the midst of the congregation and assembly. And this is the result of going down that way. And here is the alternative. Drink waters out of your own cistern, running waters out of your own well. Let your fountain be dispersed abroad, and rivers of waters in the street, and let them only be your own and not a stranger's with you. In other words, your own family unit. And that's what's being destroyed in today's society. Let your fountain be blessed, and rejoice with the wife of your youth. Let her be as a loving hind and pleasant roe. Let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be ravished always with her love. Why will you be ravished with a strange woman and embrace the bosom of a stranger? For the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Eternal, and he ponders all his goings. Yet his own iniquities shall take the wicked himself, and he shall be held with the cords of his sins, and he will die without instruction, and in the greatness of his folly he will go astray. Now that chapter really hits the subject of sexual health on the head. Because it is. It's the height of folly. It talks about Esau as that profane individual. Esau sold his birthright. It talks about, so somebody who has this kind of concept of fornication, about going ahead and spreading his seed wherever he wants to. This is it's an erroneous way of looking at things. It's not the relationship, it's not there. Another couple of points just before we close. One is that churchgoers live longer, study finds. It says, weekly attendance of religious services increase the longevity of worshippers. A new study is found, possibly because of greater inner peace. And it goes on, it says, even after accounting for health risk factors such as smoking, churchgoers had lower mortality rates, concluded this particular report. And so on. I haven't got time to read it all. Another report. It says, generous oldsters live longer. United Press International, November the 13th, 2002. It says, older Americans who are generous with their time and help can reduce their risk of dying prematurely by 60%. A new study released Wednesday suggests. Again, it just backs up. You get a mind going in a certain direction. You get a relationships going along the lines that God has as relationships, and the way in which God is wanting those relationships to go, and we will be physically better off. We will be physically, our bodies will function properly, because the mind is a gland. A couple of scriptures in closing. First of all, Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 23, it says, be renewed in the spirit of your mind. This is instruction to the church. And that you put on the new man. It's not just a spiritual new man, although that is what is being talked about. It also has an effect on our physical health as well. That mind, as our gland, will give us physical health and give us physical benefits if that new man, which he after God is created in righteousness and true holiness. So that mind has an effect on our physical health also. Therefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbor, for we're members of one another. The relationship. You don't lie to one another. We're members of one another. Therefore, we speak truth. Be angry, but don't sin. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. Now, do we believe this? Do we obey this? Or do we sit and brood? Remember what I read out about cancer. It's this bottled emotion that actually causes cancer in many cases. Don't let the sun go down on the wrath. Neither give place to the devil, because once that, if the sun goes down and we start brooding on it, then Satan's got his a highway straight in there. He does. He just does. It's a Jack story. We brood on it. You say, you know, Jack story. You know, that's for not lending me the Jack. Because you walk up to this house late at night and you're wanting to get this Jack. And you smack somebody on the nose because of it. Because it's all been brewing up in your own mind. But he says, don't give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have to give to him that needs. It's this outgoing attitude. The purpose of work, the purpose of money, is so that we have something to give. Don't let corrupt communication get out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace to the hearers, so that people that hear it are actually, it's not as a talebearer that goes around and pierces to the innermost parts of the belly that we just read about, but somebody that actually builds up. And don't grieve the Holy Spirit of God with which you are sealed to the day of redemption. Let all bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, evil speaking be put away from you with all malice, and be kind one to another and tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake has forgiven you. And you, it says, give and it will be given to you. If we give that kind of forgiveness to others, it's given to us. And more than that, even physically, we have this gland, which is our mind, which also gives to us literally, and quite literally, physically. Philippians chapter 4, just a final scripture. It says, rejoice in the Lord always, verse 4, and again I say rejoice. Let your moderation or your yieldedness be known to all. The Lord is at hand. He's going to come. Our relationship with God must be intact. And it says here, be careful, be over anxious for nothing, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. We move forward on our knees, we don't have to worry about things. We get our relationship right with God, we get our relationship right with one another, and we will then weather the storms as they come along. And the peace of God, which passes all understanding, will keep your hearts and minds through Christ Jesus. And finally, brethren, whatever things are true and honest and just, whatever things are pure, whatever things are lovely, whatever things are good report, if there's any virtue, if there's any praise, you think on these things. Because the mind is a gland. It has effect on our very physical health, and it needs to be taken account of just as much as food, just as much as exercise, and all the other, you know, as far as air is concerned, just as much as the environment that we find ourselves in, or the time that we devote to sleep. That mind and that relationship that we have, both with God and with fellow man, is of absolute vital importance.